where to begin with questions for this panel. I was actually trying to tweet before. I can't tweet, take notes, take in some of the questions that should be asked all at the same time because there are so many coming thick and fast. So this is where you're meant to be doing it. Please use the SMS number or prepare yourself to stick up your hand when I quickly come down shortly with a microphone. Let me just start, though, with a couple of the broader questions. Siddharth, since you were just here and the podium's still warm, at the end of all that, as an analyst, what are you telling people to buy in the sector? What are you telling them to sell? Who's worth working for in this game?
To be honest, Michael, we're actually quite concerned about prospects going forward for the general insurance sector from the perspective of the equity market. So we don't have any buyers in the Australian general insurance space. And certainly we think at some point growth will be a real concern for the sector. It's exacerbated for the large domestic players because they are losing share as well. So I think we're going into a lower growth environment and they're losing share in that environment. So we're a little bit cautious.
Maybe I should channel the CEOs here. because when I did get to the end of my discussions with a couple of the CEOs, it sort of looked like a lot of doom and gloom. But I would say that a number of the CEOs were very positive about the opportunities that all the change gave, and that they didn't want to talk about that so much with me, and we were talking specifically on challenges, but certainly within that challenge, a lot of the CEOs are very positive about the opportunities that also provided. So I'll just sort of rebut that from the CEO's perspective.
They're even more positive when they speak to me, I can tell you.
Well, to quote Mandy Rice Davies, they would say that, wouldn't they? So the message is, folks, you better find another job because all the insurance companies here, they're crap. No one wants to buy them. From a more actuarial point of view and also just from a market analyst point of view, because those margins are so fat at present, does that inevitably mean? Is that why you're not recommending them? Simply because if economics works, those margins should be eaten by other players and they're probably due for a spell of bad weather anyway.
The weather has been very, very favourable. I think, where margins should be is not dictated by history. I think it's more just that if you have high margins but you're losing share, that isn't a sustainable position to continue. Mm-hmm. Because if one of the advantages that you talk about are really scale, you can't just continue forever to be losing share. So at some point, I do think that one will have to be addressed.
Yeah.
By sacrificing the other.
Well, that segues on to Jeff. You mentioned it. No, there's not really growth. It's 2.5%. I've grown up being told Australians are underinsured. What's wrong with this industry? That it's not capable of overcoming the underinsurance, that it's not capable of growing a bit faster to make up for lost speed, and does it deserve the disruption of outsiders to overcome what would appear to be a terrible inertia of slackness and underperformance? Stir that one up.
How many houses do you own, Michael?
Houses? I own one and the bank owns a couple.
Okay. So how many house insurance policies do you need?
If I was efficient, I could probably go to a broker. They seem to be the way to go, but I'm not efficient, so I've got three different policies.
I'm very sanguine about all that because the vast majority of insurance coverage is protecting either assets or contingent liabilities that continue to exist. The number of car insurance policies sold is going to be roughly equal to the number of cars owned, less a proportion that can't afford it or decide to self-insure. So the demand will always be there at a level, but it's not a real growth market. And I think this is where Sid's problem or potential problem with the current share prices of the major listed companies are concerned, because the only way to look at those share prices in a sort of market rational way is to build onto current quite strong margins an implied level of growth, and that won't be there in the Australian market unless someone can totally outperform. So this is a personal view. I care more about sustainable profit than I do about growth. And I'd love to be able to run a business that's turning out very good sustainable profits year after year with a flat top line.
Which segues into something Vicky wants to say and then a question that's been SMS'd.
Yes, I was just wanted to add to what's been said. I think perhaps what we're talking about here are growth opportunities for insurers in the Australian market. And one thing I wanted to mention is that the rate of financial exclusion in Australia has been measured at 17%. And what that means is that 17% of our population is not able to easily access a credit, a transactional banking product, or a simple general insurance product. Now, a reaction to that might be, well, there's nothing really to be gained by selling low-cost, simple products to people on low incomes. But I think what we need to realise as an industry that the student today at TAFE might be the accountant in the economy in 5 years' time. So from what we're seeing at the Insurance Council, I think there is a tremendous opportunity there to really, really properly understand what the needs of consumers are. And I just go back to what I said about what we're seeing in the call centre is that, yes, people need their home contents, they need their home property, they need their motor insurance. There is such a diversity of need out there in the community just with people on the ground who are not sophisticated purchasers. And the issue that we get to with disclosure is that someone with a vacant lot, for example, or someone with a mobility scooter not knowing where they go to get insurance because they're trying to do the right thing, that person probably wouldn't think to go to a broker. And I query whether a broker would be the right person for some of those people anyway, because the actual cost of their premium for their risk is possibly quite low. So I get back to the issue about effective disclosure and probably also simple advice. So to summarise all of that, I think there is real opportunity in the market. And I think we have to get better at disclosure, and we've got to get better at some simple advice models for consumers. And I think that will help the industry move forward and find those opportunities that are currently not being met.
There's a segue to a question that's been texted in for you, Vicky, and that is, if legislation does permit UFIs to offer cover Australia-wide, do you anticipate widespread use of this opportunity by foreign insurers?
That's a really good question. And I think that part of the answer to that might be that brokers would be very wary, because what we're picking up is some brokers agitating around the fact that their professional indemnity insurers may not cover them for offering consumers home insurance through this arrangement. There's also the question as to whether UFIs would want to pick up those kinds of risks up in far north Queensland, given that they keep getting slammed by cyclones. But I think that the issue I've got with it is that it sends a signal basically saying that the broker is responsible for the consumer protection, because you don't have any protection under the prudential regime in Australia. And as a consumer, if you gained your home insurance through this proposed mechanism through a broker with a UFI, where do you go if the claim is not paid? You can't go to FOS. So I think the answer to the question, will it be taken up? I think time will tell. Who knows? But we're kind of hopeful that some other forces at play will inhibit the take-up, even if the amendment to the reg actually gets through.
Now, there's another question on the floor which I might embroider a little bit. The question is, why have the major banks chosen not to get involved in general insurance in a major way? Which I think also leads into a question about big data, which Jeff's insight, it's not your big data, it's the other people's that really counts. And also, Estelle, you mentioned it. My question is, for all the talk about big data, as a consumer, I can see Coles and Woolworths using it on me, but I can't see insurance companies using it on me. I can't see individualised offers in the pricing and the offers being made to me, as someone with a fair bit of stuff to insure. Is it all talk and not that much action? Estelle?
I think that in the insurance, I mean, obviously, big data, a lot of big data did grow up in that sort of retail space. So the people like Cole, in terms of with the customers, so, and the sales and the marketing piece. So obviously, I think they're more evolved in their usage of it. Insurers are getting there. Every insurer's got a big data strategy, and they're in various stages of executing on that strategy. So
are you channeling CEOs again, or is that what you really think?
So I would say it's sort of, we will see it emerge over about the next.
Well, to link it back to that question, to link it back to that question, if the major banks actually use big data, how could they not get into general insurance and kill the market? Jeff, have you got a thought on that?
Well, I think you're right. A number of the banks don't want to underwrite insurance because they see it as too volatile and they've got better things to do with their money, more profitable things to do with their money. It does take me back to the manufacturing situation, and Coles is a great example. There's probably about five people in this room that really know about the profitable growth in Coles insurance, and they're not going to say, and I don't know. The Coles insurance initiative really kicked off in a big way when Wesfarmers owned both Coles and an insurance company. It's not that it can't be done without that, but it really produced a great deal of commitment. Now, of course, Wesfarmers has sold its insurance company, and we all wonder what that's going to do. But to me, the proof of the pudding is in how profitable the Coles car insurance business is, which we don't know, because they advertised a heap, they were pretty cheap. Did they really have the risk selection power through flybys to be able to choose the right people? And we don't know. Someone mentioned the arms race. I think they're still in design, not build.
This is my chance to do a Jerry Springer impersonation, microphone on the floor, so you don't have to do all that fumbling around with your thumbs, and if you'd baby Burma rather than Genoa, you don't really want to do that. Question from the floor.
Hi, Amanda Aitken from Actuarial Edge. Question for Vicky. Vicky, you talked about the challenge of regulation being able to keep up with technology. Are there parts of the world that are particularly leading the way in this area?
Gosh, probably the best example I could think of would be what's happened fairly recently in California, where the Californian legislature did, I think it actually might still be in the process of attempting to pass legislation to require the likes of Uber and Lyft and Sidecar to have appropriate insurance. So I think the short answer is everyone's struggling. And obviously, in the States where a lot of these things have actually started up, the legislatures there are just realising that they're a bit behind the game. And my understanding is, in particular with Uber, that this insurance issue was prompted by the death of a six-year-old killed by an Uber driver. And the challenge there was that the issue is, where does the domestic insurance stop and where does the commercial insurance kick in? Is it when the Uber driver's got into his or her car, or is it when they turn the app on and start taking bookings for drives, or is it when they actually pick up the passenger? And so there is a real question there. So, sorry, it's a long way. I don't know. I think everyone's in catch-up mode. And I think California is the best example because they're probably the first movers in the sense that some of these platforms came out of San Francisco.
California, for better or worse. Another question?
Jeff Thorpe from Westpac General Insurance. One of the things you commented about having to get documentation out to people so they can understand it and stuff like that. One of the problems we find is even if you write five lines, people will throw it out before they actually read it. Yeah. Have you got any thoughts on how you actually get people to read stuff once it is simple enough for them to understand it?
Yeah, thank you. That's another really good question, and it gives me an opportunity to soapbox a little bit on an idea that we've got. Look, I was really pleased to see the ASIC consultation paper come out on Friday. Like I said, they've opened up the conversation around the greater electronic distribution of PDSs and whether PDSs could be interactive. One of the things that we're looking at the Insurance Council through our Understand Insurance website, which is a financial literacy initiative, is the use of checklists. And I think that tees up with what we're learning from behavioural insights and this concept of the nudge theory. What actually causes someone, moves them away from just trying to read pages and pages of text? What do you need to do to make that consumer actually think, what is it that I need? Is this product offering me what I need? So I think a checklist approach to information in a PDS is a really good one. And you can almost imagine if you had an interactive PDS that if someone were to interrogate it with the questions that were relevant to their needs, it could almost generate a bespoke key fact sheet. So there's some exciting things that I think that can be done. But I think that the challenge is to assist the consumer to know exactly what the questions are that need to be asked so the PDS can be appropriately interrogated.
Jeff, we've had a disclosure-based regime for about 15 years, and in the financial system inquiry there's been a lot of talk that, OK, well, that's great, but it doesn't do the job, and it never will, because Michael chooses not to spend the time reading his insurance policies. So a lot of the talk there has been about continuing to move to product provider responsibility for fit for purpose. Not to say that financial literacy is not important, but it's not going to do the job on its own.
Nothing I like more than kicking back on the weekend with a couple of PDFs. We'll squeeze another couple of questions in.
Sranjit Padmanabhan for Vicky. Thank you very much for your comments, particularly about this unmet need from consumers for certain types of insurance that insurers aren't offering and the potential growth there. I wonder if you had any insights into, you know, what's stopping insurers doing that? I mean, is there a systemic or a cultural or just a technological, or what kind of reasons are stopping insurers actually meeting the needs of consumers in those areas?
I think I actually don't know. I haven't got an obvious answer, but it may go to scale. And obviously, you know, there's a huge scale in home contents, home property, motor, etc. But where someone has quite a unique need, and I will use the mobility scooter example again, someone's got a mobility scooter, that person has a disability or they're older and they need some assistance getting around doing their shopping. Is an insurer going to provide a cheap, simple public liability policy to someone with a mobility scooter? Probably not now, but I question whether with an ageing population, whether if in 20 years' time we're all on mobility scooters, I probably will be, I'm sure, because my knees are giving out, whether scale will actually prompt insurers to start developing some policies. And the issue with Airbnb, for example, is a really, really good one, because now that thousands, if not tens or hundreds of thousands of people are signing up their properties so that they can utilise their domestic asset for commercial gain, perhaps a nimble insurer might start recrafting domestic home contents policies with an add-on product feature that will allow you to do that, so you know you're fully covered for public liability. So I think, you know, I think demand will drive product innovation, hopefully.
I'd just add that I think that, you know, historically it's been the underwriting agencies who have met those niche needs, and underwriting agencies are known for their, you know, high specialisation, being quite nimble and understanding those quite specific needs and putting together groups of people that make it into a viable insurance pool. I guess with you know, now with the sort of the digital economy, there's the ability for consumers to sort of find other consumers with similar needs and put their own pools together and then get deals. And that's, I think, what we're finding, that is happening now. So that would be my response.
Suncorp have just developed and released with the Brotherhood of St Lawrence a low-cost home and contents policy.
Correct.
Now, according to the program, I'm meant to be wrapping up now, but I do want to squeeze in two more questions because it's too good a panel to let the opportunity go by. One's from the floor. Siddhartha, let me put this to you. With challenges in the current growth opportunities in this market, would there be more consolidations? And what would be your view on the knock-on effect on the market? Now, the challenges you talk about, the fact that you haven't got any buyer recommendations, doesn't that say that there should be major change?
I think consolidation is hard because I think we've seen the last big acquisition. That's, you know, Wesfarmers and IAG. I think that it would be very hard for something to occur for a little while, just given the amount of consolidation that's already occurred. We do have quite a consolidated industry at the moment.
And so the big end is limited, and therefore the small insurer, the UFI, has got an opportunity.
Well, look, in that space there is opportunity for mergers, I think, but you know, there could be advantages from scale for a couple of the smaller insurers to merge, but I don't My reading is I don't think you'll see anything for a little while.
I think you have to remember that there really are almost no medium-sized insurers left in the market. Zurich is the only remaining medium-sized insurer. And once, you know, when you look at proportions of market share, once you get sort of below, and Zurich's number five, once you go below that, market shares are 2%, 1%. So you just can't even get those sort of meaningful purchases anymore.
Final question. Vicky, when you mentioned the topless waiter, I was wondering if that's what Estelle meant by non-physical assets, or is that all sorts of possibilities there. But Estelle, that problem for the CEOs and the challenge for actuaries in measuring the intangibles and how you ensure for the sorts of damages that can happen to them, how's the industry going on that?
Well, I guess if you look at the past, you know, insurers have come to grips with that, those more, I guess, not the physical assets per se. If you sort of look at the development, say, for example, even in things like D&O and directors and officers' responsibilities and things like that. So there is a ability for insurers to and actuaries, I guess, to consider those risks and build products around them. We're already seeing that with cyber insurance and products, you know, protecting privacy and reputation and things like that. But I guess it will be a case of some trial with that, which is the case whenever you get a new insurance risk.
I think some of the overseas insurers have more have a longer history of dealing with cyber insurance in particular. I think Lloyd's, there are a few syndicates there that have done it. I'm not aware if we have much in the way of capacity domestically.
But the only thing I would say with that is that the cyber risk is changing so rapidly that even a long history...
Yeah.
I mean, a long history of being in a class is always is good,
probably, yeah.
But then when things, the risk is changing so quickly, then that's...
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to interview each of these panellists at greater length, but we are out of time. Well, look, we began 5 minutes late, so we're only still running 5 minutes late, so we're still surviving. Could you please thank our wonderful panel, Estelle Pearson, Jeff Atkins, Vicky Madden, and Siddharth Mishra.